Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the February 28th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows a smiling Vladimir Putin. On his lapel, he's got both a Russian and American flag. He's pouring himself a glass of champagne. The name of the champagne is MAGA Mar-a-Lago. On a small table beside him is a red telephone and a picture of Donald Trump. The headline is Tasting Victory. Will Trump give Putin everything he wants in Ukraine and Europe? We catch that first in the second main story, but I think we'll go ahead and read both main stories this week. Trump makes mass layoffs across government. What happened? The Trump administration fired more than 16,000 federal workers across a dozen agencies this week. In a cost-cutting blitz, agency staffers said would damage the government's ability to track diseases, keep national parks open, safeguard air travel, and provide other vital services. More than 4,000 employees were axed at the Department of Agriculture, 3,400 at Forest Service, 5,200 at Health and Human Services, 2,000 at the Energy Department, and around 1,000 at Veterans Affairs. Spearheaded by the Elon Musk-led Department of Government Efficiency, the firings targeted probationary workers who have little protection from being fired without cause. Hundreds were fired at the Federal Aviation Agency, among them workers who repair air traffic control equipment. Around 1,000 National Park Service workers were cut, potentially leaving parks short-staffed during the summer high season. The sweeping layoffs stunned even some Republicans. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski called the firings indiscriminate and the administration's response to inquiries evasive and inadequate. Health agencies were hit hard by the purge, which targeted thousands of workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Food and Drug Administration, and the National Institutes of Health. Eight former health agency leaders said the cuts will impact services vital to the economic security of our nation, and the head of the FDA's food division resigned, saying the loss of key experts made it fruitless for him to stay in the role. DOGE fired, then tried to rehire staffers working on the bird flu outbreak. In a similar incident, it scrambled to recall workers fired from the National Nuclear Security Administration, which manages the U.S. nuclear arsenal. In the latest skirmish over DOGE's access to sensitive government records, the Social Security Administration's acting commissioner quit after clashing with Musk associates seeking to access personal data on millions of Americans. Federal judge denied a request by 14 states' attorneys general to bar DOGE from accessing data and terminating workers at seven federal agencies. While reports said the IRS will give a 25-year-old DOGE engineer access to sensitive taxpayer data. In a joint interview with Trump on Fox News, Musk said the cost-slashing effort was needed to fight an unelected bureaucracy and restore the will of the people. Trump said he believes Musk can trim $1 trillion in fraud and waste. He gets it done, Trump said. What the editorial said. It's time to sound the alarm, said the Seattle Times. Trimming waste is a worthy goal, but Trump and Musk are using a meat cleaver to cut off vital workforces at the knees. Here in the Pacific Northwest, their cuts could hit the Coast Guard service that helps container ships navigate our waters, the Forest Service workers who battle wildfires, and the staff that maintain the power grid. Highly trained federal workers in all those areas are now reeling from chaos and uncertainty, and may soon head for the exits. The caterwauling about Doge is premature and hysterical, said National Review. So far, it's done nothing more dire than conduct an audit of federal spending, one the president has every right to enact via any agent he sees fit to name. Efforts to weed out government waste, corruption, fraud, and stupidity should be applauded, and so should trimming a bloated bureaucracy that's unaccountable to voters. Godspeed, Mr. Musk. What the columnist said. Federal employees warn that basic functions at many agencies are under threat as critical colleagues are shown the door, said Hannah Nattinson at the Washington Post. The probationary workers being fired include not just new hires, but veteran workers who moved to new positions in the past 2 years and who hold key institutional knowledge. Their loss could affect veterans seeking mental health care, Head Start and rural assistance programs, and even hikers who get lost in national parks. It's not pretty, said Tim Swarens in USA Today, but it must be done. After decades of bipartisan fiscal mismanagement, the U.S. has accumulated an unsustainable national debt that now tops $36 trillion. About 5% of that debt was added last year alone. Hard decisions must be made to avert even more painful consequences down the road. But Doge's cuts won't put government on a more stable financial footing, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch. Federal salaries are a tiny fraction of the budget, and the tax cuts now being negotiated by congressional Republicans will add some $4 trillion to the debt. Musk claimed to have cut $55 billion already is a fantasy. This week, Doge claimed an $8 billion savings for cutting a contract actually worth only $8 million. Trump voters want a shakeup, and many cheer the wrecking ball, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. There are legitimate problems with the status quo, but the fix isn't to indiscriminately fire air traffic controllers, gut public health agencies, or cut funding for cancer research. There's an opening here for Democrats who must drive home a message. Trump is not fixing the problems you care about. He's creating new, much scarier ones. Let's be clear what's happening with Doge, said Martin Wolf in Financial Times. It's a coup that will pave the way for autocracy, plutocracy, and dysfunction. You can't boost efficiency by hacking away at a complex bureaucracy, but you can chase out conscientious workers and replace them with loyalists who'll do your every bidding. And once Trump and Musk achieve their goal of dismantling the civil service, it won't be easily rebuilt. This is destruction, not reform, and whatever they have been told, ordinary Americans will not benefit. But we know who will. And our second main story, spurning Zelensky, Trump reaches out to Putin. What happened? The Trump administration reversed 3 years of Western efforts to isolate Russia this week, negotiating directly with Vladimir Putin's regime over the war in Ukraine and signaling that the U.S. would abandon its longstanding commitment to European security. President Trump shocked allies by speaking to Putin in a wide-ranging 90-minute phone call that set up a meeting between Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov this week in Riyadh. There, the officials agreed to restaff their embassies, consider joint ventures such as Arctic energy exploration, and negotiate peace in Ukraine. Rubio said ending that war would create incredible opportunities for the U.S. to partner with Russia. Trump then got into a remarkable war of words with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After Zelensky rejected a Trump administration proposal that Ukraine give the U.S. half of its vast mineral resources, saying such a deal must come with ironclad security guarantees, Trump called him a dictator for failing to hold elections during the war. He even blamed the conflict, which began when Russian troops invaded Ukraine in 2022, on Zelensky, saying, you should have never started it. You could have made a deal. Zelensky countered that Trump was repeating Russian disinformation. In Europe, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Ukraine was unlikely ever to join NATO or regain territory occupied by Russia, while Vice President J.D. Vance accused European leaders of retreating from democratic values. He said the threat to European countries from Russia pales in comparison with a threat from within that stems from sidelining of far-right parties. But Zelensky said without U.S. protection, the risk that Russia will occupy Europe is 100%. What the editorial said. Ukraine and its European allies braced for the worst when Trump won a second term, said The Guardian. But the scale of its surrender to Russian aggression has still shocked them. Trump has not only excluded Europe from peace talks, he's given away every bargaining chip before those talks even begin, including the return of Ukrainian territory and Ukrainian membership in NATO. The one bright spot is the forceful response to Trump from European leaders who remain committed to Kyiv. The message that Americans are shipping out unless Europe shapes up has triggered howls across the continent, said the Wall Street Journal, but it needed to be said. Previous warnings about European countries not meeting their NATO obligations have gone unheeded for decades. Yes, a U.S. withdrawal from Europe would be a historic mistake, but so would Europe's failure to take more responsibility for its own defense. What the columnist said. Selling out Ukraine to Russia is a drastic turnaround for the party of Ronald Reagan, said Jonathan Lemire in The Atlantic. The Republican Party once prided itself on standing up to Moscow and getting it to tear down the Berlin Wall. Now it has bowed to a president who himself is bowing to an adversary. Trump is effectively saying that Ukraine should just give up because Russia is stronger. He's telling Europe to face the facts, said Rich Lowry in National Review. Ukraine is not realistically going to be a member of NATO or recover Crimea. Yet Russia is not currently in a position of strength, said The Economist. Its army has performed dismally, suffering staggering losses and failing for months to take the strategic city of Pokrovsk. It has burned through half its tank supply, and in 2024 it lost twice as many artillery systems as in the preceding 2 years. This may be the worst possible time for the U.S. to dictate concessions. And not just for Ukraine's sake, said George F. Will in the Washington Post. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain thought he, too, was being realistic when he handed Hitler chunks of Czechoslovakia, fatally weakening its defenses. But appeasement only sharpened the dictator's appetite. Today, Trump claims Europe's vulnerability is not America's concern because we have an ocean between us and Russia. Has he forgotten the ICBMs that can fly right over that ocean? Barbarian regimes will be barbaric until stopped, and appeasing Putin in Ukraine will lead to a wider war. Controversy of the week. Justice Department condoning corruption under Trump. The rule of law has long been the cornerstone of American freedom, said Carol C. Lamb in the New York Times. But as the song says, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. The Justice Department last week ordered Danielle Sassoon, acting U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, to dismiss the corruption case against New York City's Democratic mayor, Eric Adams. Instead, Sassoon, a rising conservative legal star who clerked for the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, handed in her resignation. In a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi, she explained that Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bove had made clear to her and Adams' attorney that the bribery charges were being dropped not because the case was flawed, but so the mayor could aid President Trump's immigration crackdown. This amounted to a quid pro quo, Sassoon wrote, and she could not, in good conscience, participate. Bove blasted Sassoon for insubordination, said Nick Cotaggio in the Dispatch. But by that point, six other prosecutors in Sassoon's office had also resigned rather than participate in Bove's drug deal, as did several lawyers in the Justice Department's public integrity section and four of Adams' deputy mayors. They all deserve immense moral credit for their principled resignations, though it will do little to impede Trump's efforts to turn American law into a patronage system. What justice did here was more ham-handed than despotic, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. The department's independence from politics has always been a matter of rituals and appearances more than reality. If Bode had simply argued that the case against Adams just wasn't strong enough, and the allegations that he accepted illegal campaign contributions and travel perks from Turkish government-linked sources are underwhelming, the Trump-appointed Sassoon would not have resigned. Adams' fate is now unclear, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The judge overseeing his case is examining the dismissal request, and New York Governor Kathy Hochul may remove him as mayor. But nothing will undo what Bove's awful political judgment has done to the reputation of this Justice Department. This was no accident, said Joe Nocera in the Free Press. As with his pardon of January 6 rioters, Trump's leniency toward Adams, who has been slathering Trump with public praise, broadcast the message that it pays to be a friend of Donald Trump. But Trump's friendship is conditional, said the New York Times in an editorial. Bove wants the case dismissed without prejudice, meaning charges can later be refiled, giving Trump control over Adams in perpetuity. The extent of that control became clear last week when Adams appeared on Fox News with Trump border czar Tom Homan and collegially discussed letting ICE agents into city jail, potentially violating city law. If he doesn't come through, Homan said, I'll be in his office, up his butt, saying, where the hell is the agreement we came to? Trump may eventually regret this ugly deal, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg, not because of Democratic opprobrium or even the damage to Justice Department morale. Rather, it's the message sent by the resignation of Sassoon and other prosecutors, who are among the most intelligent, qualified conservatives in the U.S. government. They could become role models for principled conservative lawyers and judges throughout our legal system, from the bottom to perhaps the top. When historians seek to understand how Trump lost a Supreme Court to which he appointed three members, the resignations may be seen as a crucial turning point. And our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for ripple effects after Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker announced that Lake Michigan will now be known as Lake Illinois. And the mayor of Weymouth, Massachusetts, announced that Hingham Bay, which adjoins the city, will henceforth be known as the Gulf of Weymouth. Mayor Bob Hedlund said President Trump's decision to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America inspired him to correct this historical inaccuracy. It was a good week for archaeologists after researchers who examined nine ancient Egyptian mummies reported being surprised by the pleasantries of the aroma emitted by the 5,000-year-old human remains. Researcher Cecilia Bembibre characterized the smell as woody, spicy, and sweet. It was a good week for capitalism, after the surging price of eggs inspired some New York City convenience stores to start selling eggs outside the carton, the same sales model by which they vend Lucy single cigarettes. But it was a bad week for transparency after the Trump administration claimed in a court filing that Elon Musk is not the leader of the Department of Government Efficiency or even part of the cost-slashing initiative, despite President Trump crediting the billionaire with doing a great job as Doge head. It was a bad week for kids today after Sicilian police secretly recorded a group of alleged mafiosi bemoaning the miserable quality of new recruits. A particular concern is the youngsters' lack of fortitude under police interrogation, complained one mobster, which has left the group on our knees. Finally, it was a bad week for neighborliness after three separate fights broke out in the first 9 seconds of a U.S.-Canada hockey match. Before the Four Nations face-off game in Montreal, which the U.S. won 3-1, Canadian fans booed the Star-Spangled Banner to express their opposition to President Trump's proposal that Canada become America's 51st state. Time for the briefing, titled this week, PEPFAR's Uncertain Future. That's P-E-P-F-A-R. The U.S.-funded effort against AIDS has saved millions of lives. Why is it now in jeopardy? What is PEPFAR? The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief is a U.S. aid program that combats HIV/AIDS worldwide. Launched in 2003 by President George W. Bush, it has blunted the global HIV pandemic by testing hundreds of millions of people and giving those who are infected life-saving antiretroviral drugs, medications that prevent human immunodeficiency virus from developing into AIDS. PEPFAR has also distributed billions of condoms and prevented transmission from mothers to babies by giving women and girls reproductive education and health screenings. In just over two decades, these efforts have saved more than 26 million lives across 55 countries, reduced child mortality by 35%, and increased global GDP per capita by more than 2%. Why did Bush set it up? HIV/AIDS was rampant in Africa when Bush took office, infecting more than one-third of adults in some countries. While there were new drugs available, fewer than 1% of the 30 million HIV-positive people on the continent were getting them, and AIDS was killing 2 million Africans a year. President Bill Clinton had already declared AIDS a national security threat, fearing the 14 million kids left orphaned by those deaths would be ripe for recruitment by militias and terrorist groups. In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack, Bush proposed an ambitious U.S.-funded scheme to stop the pandemic spread. And Representative Henry Hyde, a fiscally conservative Republican, took the lead in Congress to pass legislation establishing the program. "I'm not naive enough to think PEPFAR was purely altruistic," said Ugandan journalist Daniel Kalinake. "It was a defensive mechanism that turned into something good, arguably America's biggest foreign policy win." Since its passage, PEPFAR has enjoyed bipartisan support, with Congress continuously reauthorizing the program at some $25 billion every 5 years. But now its funding may be cut off. Why is the program at risk? PEPFAR was one of the initiatives halted in the blanket freeze on foreign aid President Trump declared last month. its 270,000 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists were told to not report to work and to turn away patients who came for their antiretroviral drugs. I was warned by my doctor not to miss a single dose because that could lead to resistance, said Millicent Muyoma, a Kenyan woman with HIV. I don't know what will happen if I don't secure my medicine soon. Secretary of State Marco Rubio eventually issued a humanitarian waiver for PEPFAR so it could resume HIV testing and drug distribution. But the program is now in chaos. Hundreds of organizations in Africa said their access to PEPFAR-funded resources has not resumed, and they are still turning people away. Doctors Without Borders reported that none of the AIDS clinics in its network has been able to resume work. Meanwhile, even if the freeze is ultimately lifted, it's unclear whether Congress will re-up PEPFAR for another five-year term when its funding expires in March. Why might Congress cut funding? In 2023, the Conservative Heritage Foundation put out a damning report saying that PEPFAR had become inefficient and politicized, a subsidy program for a giant contractors and NGOs, overwhelmingly Democratic Party supporters, that were promoting a leftist agenda of LGBTQ ideology. Republican lawmakers began to balk at funding the program. Then, last month, U.S. officials said they had discovered that over the past 4 years, a small amount of PEPFAR money has gone to a health clinic in Mozambique that provides abortions in addition to HIV services. That's a violation of the Helms Amendment, which prohibits U.S. government from funding abortions. Republicans now say they won't reauthorize PEPFAR unless more oversight is added. It is disgusting that the Biden administration has allowed taxpayer dollars to be used to perform abortions overseas, said Senator Jim Risch, Republican from Idaho. The future of PEPFAR program is certainly in jeopardy. Can the program be reformed? The process is already underway. The U.S. has secured reimbursement from Mozambique for the salaries of the four nurses who provided abortions, and clinics receiving PEPFAR money will now be required to certify that they do not offer abortion care. Some House Republicans say they might be willing to authorize a single year of funding rather than five, to get the Trump administration time to curb the program's bloat and woke excesses. But Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a vocal critic of PEPFAR as a whole. He says the fight against AIDS has been driven by pharmaceutical companies, Africa's cruelest and most deadly colonial overlord, and he may advocate for PEPFAR to be canceled. What effect would that have? We can very rapidly return to where the pandemic is exploding, like it was back in the 1980s, said Steve Deeks, an HIV expert at the University of California. More than 220,000 people pick up antiretroviral drugs through PEPFAR every day. Within a week of missing their medication, their viral load will shoot up from undetectable levels to more than 100,000 viral particles per millimeter of blood, and they can become spreaders of the disease. As with antibiotics, pausing the course of treatment makes the drugs less effective when they are resumed, which means more drug-resistant variants and less of a chance at one day developing a vaccine. HIV testing, too, would stop. It's unlikely that we will be able to even diagnose people who need to go into treatment, said Glenda Gray, a pediatric HIV doctor in South Africa, where a PEPFAR shutdown would add more than 500,000 new HIV infections over the next decade. Children who are untreated are likely to die. And a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Trump as a faux populist. Trump campaigned as a populist, said David Brooks. But as president has shown, he really seems not to give a crap about the working class. Trump won largely because working class Americans feel, quite justifiably, that the system isn't working for them. The education gap between wealthy and poor students is now greater than the gap between white and black people in the era of Jim Crow. And Americans without college degrees die about 8 years sooner than graduates. The modern economy has left small towns and rural areas behind. But after tapping into working class resentment for votes, Trump has given the keys to the federal government to Ivy League billionaire Elon Musk and his mob of 20-something techies. This well-off, arrogant wrecking crew is no less elite than the career civil servants, scientists, and regulators they want to drive out of government. A populist would try to improve government agencies, but Musk's nihilist crowd wants to destroy them and the services they provide to the rural poor, to disabled people, and to children. This is not a working-class revolt against the elites. It's one section of the educated elite going after another. Making corruption great again. Bribery is basically legal now as long as you support or are Donald Trump, said Jonathan Chait. The president has launched a blizzard of blatantly pro-corruption actions, firing the director of the Office of Government Ethics and 17 federal inspectors general, pardoning former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich for his corruption conviction, suspending the prosecution against New York Mayor Eric Adams, who allegedly solicited foreign bribes, and halting enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which prohibits U.S. companies from bribing foreign officials. Why? Trump genuinely believes in corruption as a normal and acceptable way to do business. His worldview was formed in New York's real estate industry, where he greased the palms and cultivated public officials and mobsters to get development permits, subsidies, tax breaks, and construction materials. In the White House, he continues to run his business empire while refusing to disclose his tax returns, and has even launched a new crypto meme coin that enables any influence seeker to enrich him. These stunning violations of anti-corruption norms reveal Trump's understanding of how power works. The people running the system operate it for their own benefit. The rest of us are suckers. This column comes from Canada, a nation's failure to launch. Canadian 20-somethings are stuck in their childhood bedroom, said Claire Gagne. In the old days, we used the term boomerang kids to refer to young people who tried to set out on their own but wound up moving back in with mom and dad. There were the exceptions, and frankly, a lot of us viewed them as screw-ups. But now Canada's astronomical housing costs and stagnant wages make real-world finances daunting for most of our young adults. In the 1990s, about 30% of people in their 20s were still under their parents' roofs. That figure has now jumped to 46%. Worse, 30% are still in the parental home at age 30, up from just 11% in 1981. And these statistics, the most recent we have, are from 2021, well before post-pandemic inflation sent the cost of living soaring. It's not all downside, of course. There are real benefits of lifestyle that go well beyond economics. A multi-generational household used to be the norm, after all, and it can make family life much easier, with grandparents taking care of babies and adult kids doing chores for aging parents. The trend could even help turn around the loneliness epidemic that health experts warn is having dire effects on Canadians. Still, it's a huge adjustment for everyone, not least the parents. There's no handbook for rooming with someone whose butt you use to wipe. And time for the last word, our feature article, title this week, Hitler's Oligarchs. In the 1930s, German industrialists rallied behind the Nazi leader in pursuit of profit, said Timothy W. Ryback in The Atlantic. It was a decision many would come to regret. He was among the richest men in the world. He made his first fortune in heavy industry. He made his second as a media mogul. And in January 1933, in exchange for a political favor, Alfred Hugenberg provided the electoral capital that made possible Adolf Hitler's appointment as chancellor. Before Hugenberg sealed his pact with Hitler, a close associate had warned Hugenberg that this was a deal he would come to regret. One night you will find yourself running through the ministry gardens in your underwear, trying to escape arrest. In my recent book, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power, I chronicled the fraught relationship between the tyrant and the titan, but my story ended in January 1933, so I did not detail the subsequent impact on Hugenberg's fortunes, let alone the catastrophic consequences that lay ahead for other corporate leaders, their companies, and their country. In the 20s and early 30s, the Hitler brand was anathema to capitalists and corporate elites. His National Socialist German Workers' Party was belligerently nationalistic, but also unapologetically socialistic, a true Arbeiter Partei, or Working Man's Party. Its 25-point political platform explicitly targeted bankers and financiers, calling for breaking the bondage of interest, as well as industrialists who profited from wartime production. Profits were to be confiscated by the state without compensation, and corporate executives charged with treason. Through the 1920s, businessmen preferred to place their political bets with conservative, centrist, business-friendly politicians, such as those in the Center Party or the Bavarians People Party or the right-wing but decidedly pro-business German nationalists. Out of necessity, then, the National Socialists had to derive most of their financing via membership fees, stormtroopers standing on street corners begging for contributions, and admission charges to Hitler rallies. Among the exceptions to this were socialites: Victoria von Dershken, Helene Bechstein, Elsa Bruckmann, who were smitten with Hitler. But the most significant exception was Fritz Thyssen. Thyssen, heir to one of Germany's leading industrial fortunes, had been an earlier financier of the Nazi movement. He first met Hitler in the autumn of 1923 after attending a beer hall rally. Thyssen provided the party, by his own estimate, approximately 1 million Reichsmarks, more than $5 million today, and also helped finance the acquisition and refurbishment of a Munich palace as the Nazi Party headquarters. Most important, Thyssen arranged for Hitler to speak to his fellow industrialist in Dusseldorf in January 27, 1932. The speech made a deep impression on the assembled industrialists, Thyssen said, and in consequence of this, a number of large contributions flowed from the resources of heavy industry into the treasuries of the National Socialist Party. This financing, estimated at a still cautious 2 million marks annually, was channeled through a trusted intermediary, Alfred Hugenberg. Hugenberg had served as director of Krupp AG, the large steel maker and arms manufacturer during the Great War, and had subsequently founded the Telegraph Union, a conglomerate of more than 1,400 associated newspapers. Hugenberg also bought controlling shares in the country's largest movie studio. Hugenberg practiced what he called Katastrophenpolitik, the politics of catastrophe, by which he sought to polarize public opinion and the political parties with incendiary news stories, some of them fabrikationen, entirely fabricated articles intended to cause confusion and outrage. According to one such story, the government was enslaving German teenagers and selling them to its allies in order to service its war debt. Hugenberg calculated that by hollowing out the political center, political census would become impossible and the democratic system would collapse. As a right-wing delegate to the Reichstag, Hugenberg proposed a freedom law that called for liberation of German people from the shackles of democracy and from the onerous provisions of the Versailles Treaty. The law called for the treaty signatories to be tried and hanged for treason, along with government officials involved with implementing the treaty provisions. Hugenberg, who had leveraged his wealth into political power, had become the leader of the German National People's Party, which had the votes in the Reichstag that Hitler needed to be appointed chancellor. After a cantankerous negotiation, a deal was reached. Hugenberg would deliver Hitler the chancellorship in exchange for Hugenberg being given a cabinet post as head of Superministerium that subsumed the ministries of economics, agriculture, and nutrition. Once in the cabinet, Hugenberg didn't hesitate to meddle in foreign relations when it suited him. Reinhold Kautz, a close Hugenberg associated, distilled Hugenberg's calculus as follows. Hitler will sit in the saddle, but Hugenberg holds the whip. Hitler, however, soon no longer needed Hugenberg's corporate contacts or his Reichstag delegates. The bankers and industrialists who had once shunned the crass, divisive right-wing extremist had gradually come to embrace him as a bulwark against the pro-union social democrats and the virulently anti-capitalist communist. On Monday, February 20, 1933, Hermann Göring, one of two Nazi ministers in the Hitler cabinet and the president of the Reichstag, hosted a fundraiser at his official residence for the Nazi Party in advance of upcoming elections. The event was presided over by Hjalmar Schacht, a respected banker and co-founder of a centrist political party who saw Hitler as the best bet against left-wing political forces and had lobbied President Paul von Hindenburg to appoint Hitler chancellor. Among the two dozen industrialists, bankers, and businessmen in attendance, the most prominent was Gustav Krupp von Bohlen, known as the Cannon King for his armament production. "I was astonished," Schacht said, "because I knew that this same Krupp von Bohlen had refused an invitation from Fritz Thyssen to attend an event with the Rhine-Westphalian industrialist 4 weeks earlier." Perhaps equally surprising was the presence at this fundraiser of four directors from the board of the giant chemical and pharmaceutical conglomerate IG Farben, which had to that point been staunchly pro-democracy, pro-Weimar Republic, and anti-national socialist. The Nazis derided the company, which employed many Jewish scientists, as an international capitalist Jewish company. Hitler himself stunned party attendees by showing up as the unannounced guest of honor. Clad in a suit and a tie rather than a brown stormtrooper's uniform, Hitler addressed the assembled corporate elite, warning of the damages of communism and trumpeting his appointment as chancellor as a great victory that he saw as a mandate for radical change. He outlined his plans to restore the power of the military, assert totalitarian control over the country, destroy the parliamentary system, and crush all political opponents by force. Private enterprise cannot be maintained in the age of democracy, Hitler told them. After Hitler departed, Schock spoke of the need for additional campaign financing in advance of the upcoming elections. Hermann Göring added that the election, scheduled for March 5th, will surely be the last one for the next 10 years, probably even for the next 100 years. By day's end, the fundraiser had generated 3 million Reichsmarks, the equivalent of $15 million today. The following 3 weeks delivered a series of blows to the Weimar Republic that resulted in its demise. The arson attack on the Reichstag on February 27th, which saw the very symbol of parliamentarian democracy consumed in flame. The March 5th election, from which the Nazis emerged with a mandate for Hitler's reforms. And the passing of an enabling law on March 23rd. That established Hitler as unchallenged dictator. In a letter to Hitler, Gustav Krupp wrote, "The turn of political events is in line with the wishes which I myself and the board of directors have cherished for a long time." German corporations, large and small, helped retool the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich as the Third Reich. Ferdinand Porsche designed the Volkswagen, a car for the people. Mercedes-Benz provided Hitler and his chief lieutenants with bulletproof sedans. Hugo Boss produced the black uniforms for the SS. Krupp supplied armaments. Mayr produced munitions. Allianz provided insurance for concentration camps. J.A. Topf and Sons manufactured crematoria ovens. For the industrialist who helped finance and supply the Hitler government, an unexpected return on their investment was slave labor. By October 1942, IG Farben and its subsidiaries were using slave laborers in 23 locations. The life expectancy of inmates at an IG Farben facility at Auschwitz was less than 4 months. More than 25,000 people lost their lives on the construction site alone. The IG Farben Pharmaceutical Division, Bayer, supported Nazi medical experiments. A post-war affidavit alleges that Bayer paid 170 Reichsmarks for 150 female Auschwitz prisoners. The transport of 150 women arrived in good condition, the affidavit reads. However, we were unable to obtain conclusive results because they died during the experiments. And we would kindly request that you send us another group of women to the same number and at the same price. Although recent investigations have questioned the veracity of this particular affidavit, Bayer's involvement in medical experimentation on Auschwitz inmates is undisputed. The IG Farben company Degussa owned a chemical subsidiary that produced a cyanide-based pesticide known as Zyklon B, used primarily for fumigating ships, warehouses, and trains. And after 1942, as a homicidal agent at Nazi extermination facilities. In August 1947, 24 senior IG Farben managers were placed on trial for their role in Nazi aggression and atrocity. The 15,638 pages of courtroom testimony, along with the 6,384 documents submitted as evidence, indicated that these Farben executives knew the exact number of airplane and truck tires, the running feet of tank tread, the amount of explosives, as well as the precise number of canisters of Zyklon B gas delivered to Auschwitz. 23 IG Farben directors were eventually charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity. 13 of them were convicted and sentenced to prison. At the International War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg in 1945, Gustav Krupp was indicted as a major war criminal alongside the likes of Göring and Hans Frank, but he was too ill to stand trial. Instead, his son was tried in 1947. in the United States of America versus Alfred Krupp et al. The indictment charged the younger Krupp, alongside 11 Krupp corporate directors, with crimes against humanity and war crimes for participating in the murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, imprisonment, torture, and use for slave labor of civilians. Alfred Krupp reportedly never expressed remorse, at one point telling War Crimes Trial Observer, "We Krupps never cared much about political ideas. We only wanted a system that worked well and allowed us to work unhindered. Politics is not our business." As for Alfred Hugenberg, unlike early private sector Hitler enablers such as Fritz Thyssen and Hjalmar Schacht, both of whom ended up in concentration camps after crossing Hitler, Hugenberg got off lightly. Hugenberg withdrew to his sprawling estate, Rohrbrocken, in the former feudal province of Lippe, where he lived as the local regent while his business empire was gradually whittled away. By war's end, the defrocked cabinet minister and disenfranchised media mogul was diminished and dissipated, but still defiant. On September 28, 1946, Hugenberg was arrested by the British military police. He was detained for 5 months, and his assets were frozen. After a formal hearing, Hugenberg was deemed to be a lesser evildoer, officially a Mitlaufer, the lowest order of complicity in the Nazi regime, on the grounds that he had left his cabinet post in the first months of the Hitler regime and had never been a member of the Nazi Party. With undiminished temerity, Hugenberg balked at even the lesser charge. Having been stripped of most of his business empire, Hugenberg saw himself as a victim of the Nazi regime. He appealed the hearing's determination and won. He was declared untainted, which allowed him to lay claim to his frozen assets. Unrepentant to his dying day, Hugenberg refused to publicly countenance any suggestion of guilt or responsibility for Hitler's excesses. On the morning of Tuesday, January 31, 1933, less than 24 hours after enabling Hitler's appointment as chancellor, Hugenberg reportedly spoke with Carl Friedrich Gordeler, a fellow conservative and the mayor of Leipzig. "I've just committed the greatest stupidity of my life," Hugenberg allegedly told Gordeler. "I have allied myself with the greatest demagogue in the history of the world." This was originally published in The Atlantic. We've run through most of our time, so I'm going to finish out today. I'm going to do one health and science piece, and then we'll move over to the shorter notes on the Talking Points page. The best way to boil an egg. Researchers say they've cracked the recipe for the perfect boiled egg, reports New Scientist, and it's very labor-intensive. Getting eggs right is tricky because the white cooks best at 185 degrees and the yolk at 149 degrees. Restaurants and gastronomically inclined home chefs have long sworn by a sous vide, an appliance that circulates the water and keeps it at a constant temperature. That method can yield a deliciously jammy yolk, but also an undercooked runny white. The scientist's solution is to have two pots of water, one boiling and the other at 86 degrees, and to swap the egg between them every 2 minutes for 8 cycles for a total of 32 minutes. The researchers devised this method by calculating how energy spreads from the shell to the yolk, then used spectrometry and an MRI-like scanner to examine the cooked result. The resulting egg is boiled to perfection. they say, and contains more nutrients than when boiled the traditional way. Yes, it takes more time, said lead author Ernesto Di Maio from the University of Naples. But I think if you love someone, you should invest your time to do something properly. Despite a small uptick in federal hiring in recent years, the percentage of the total workforce employed by the federal government is at a historic low. About 1.9% of all American workers, just over 3 million people, are employed by the federal government, compared with 3.3% in 1980 and 4.7% in 1950. Immigration and Customs Enforcement made under 600 arrests a day in the first 2 weeks of February. That's down from a daily average of 800 in late January and far below President Trump's goal of 1,200 to 1,500 migrant arrests a day. On the poll watch, 63% of Americans see Elon Musk as highly influential in the Trump administration, but only 18% want him to have a lot of influence. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from one of my favorite authors, Annie Dillard, quoted in Stat News, who says quite simply, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And, as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.